Concerns about crime have reached Ohio's congressional delegation. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we hear why an Ohio congressman wants to see the National Guard deployed to Cleveland. Then, Hamilton County residents voice their concerns about crime at a public forum, plus where you're most likely to get a parking ticket in Cincinnati, and why University of Cincinnati students held a funeral for academic freedom. Joining me now to kick off our news review are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Sabrina Eaton. Welcome back, Karen and Sabrina.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Sabrina, Congressman Max Miller wants National Guard troops deployed to Cleveland. Why?
Well, he wrote an op-ed in the Washington Times, which is a D.C. publication that has a very conservative bent, saying that a lot of people believe that crime in the U.S. is a problem, and he cited crime statistics from Cleveland from 2023. His op-ed said, "My constituents in the suburbs are afraid to go into the city. The Cleveland I grew up in is now unrecognizable. Families no longer feel safe walking down the street, and small businesses are being boarded up. Last year, an officer was killed in the line of duty by someone with a criminal history. Just this month, five people were shot after the Browns game in the flats," and it went on from there. I think that a lot of people in Cleveland were surprised by this and disagreed with the congressman's categorization of the city's crime situation. Although I did get some emails from readers who had family members, beat up and robbed and things in Cleveland. And so there's some divided opinion on that. Governor DeWine has not indicated any interest so far in sending in the National Guard, and the mayor doesn't seem to be interested in inviting them either. So I'm not sure this will go anywhere other than, being seen as a political kind of a request.
Karen, what have you heard from Governor DeWine about National Guard troops in Ohio cities, Cleveland or any other Ohio cities?
Well, he's sending in a multi-state agency group, a task force kind of thing, similar to what's happened in Cincinnati, where you've got state troopers and liquor control agents and others that are coming from the state to work with police on things like liquor violations and repeat gun offenders and things like that. And DeWine has said that that's the appropriate thing to happen here. He says the National Guard has a very different purpose and a very different mission, and it would not be appropriate to send the National Guard in because there are these other agencies that can do the work, and the National Guard should be reserved for other things. It's not the appropriate tool, he says.
Sabrina, what's the latest with the Trump administration deploying National Guard troops to cities beyond Washington, D.C.?
I believe that they are sending I think Memphis is next. I think that what they're trying to do now is go to states that have Republican governors who are more amenable to this sort of thing. Because, I mean, D.C. doesn't have a governor, but a lot of the D.C. doesn't have a governor to put the brakes on stuff like this. So Trump could just kind of do what he wanted in D.C. So I think that what Trump is trying to do is to go to states that have governors that are up for this sort of thing, and then send in troops there.
And Sabrina, what does Cleveland's crime data show? We've talked a lot on our program about Cincinnati crime data, and you know how some crimes are property crimes have increased in some places. Violent crimes have generally decreased, although they're higher in other parts of the city. What do you see in Cleveland's crime data?
Well, our crime reporters passed along information, which I put in my story, about crime and violent deaths dropping dramatically in Cleveland since the pandemic. In 2020, I think Cleveland had about 192. I think that was violent deaths, and then 128 last year, which was one of the lowest totals in years. And the city is on track for an even lower homicide rate this year if current trends continue. And in Cleveland, the police are targeting neighborhoods where the most violence takes place. So, you know, city officials are attempting to address these issues without National Guard assistance. I think that they've got, they're getting assistance from state patrol and things like that as well.
Sabrina, let's talk about Ohio's two U.S. senators. They were in the news.
Can I add one thing
here
really quick? I also asked DeWine about the idea of sending the National Guard to other states because he has not spoken out on that yet. And he reiterated his decision to send the National Guard to D.C. was consistent with decisions to send the Guard to southern states after weather disasters and to cities upon request from him. But he said that he right now has not gotten a request from Trump, and he wasn't going to do hypotheticals. But he's certainly being asked about whether that's going to be a mission coming up for the National Guard from Ohio.
Great. Well, thanks for adding that, Karen. Sabrina, I know Senator John Husted expressed some concerns about vaccine policies during a Senate hearing Wednesday. Tell us about the hearing and the concerns he expressed.
Well, the hearing was focused on the dismissal of Susan Munare as CDC director after just, I think, less than a month in office by HHS Secretary Kennedy. And they had a disagreement about vaccine policies. And she says that he was asking her to sign off on some changes without, you know, that did not have the scientific evidence to back them up, and she wasn't going to do this, and that's why she says that they parted ways. The hearing, the chair of the committee conducting the hearing, that's the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, is Bill Cassidy, who's a physician from Louisiana, and he's been very concerned about this whole vaccination thing. One of the things that he said at the hearing was that I think he mentioned that he was a doctor who focused on liver issues, and he was talking about how after hepatitis shots became, or hepatitis, you know, vaccinations became something that was commonly done for newborns, that rates of hepatitis went way down. And he talked about how sometimes, you know, kids, like babies, would get it like going through the birth canal if it was, if they had a parent who was infected. So at this hearing, John Husted is a member of the committee. And in his, every senator at these hearings gets 5 minutes where they get to ask questions or just kind of hold forth. And Husted used his time to talk about his concerns over what the federal government did in COVID, you know, with respect to school closures and vaccination, the vaccination instructions that came from the federal government. He seemed to think that what was done at that time was inappropriate. And he discussed, he felt that it was also, that there was also political interference there. And he said that, he pointed to reduced test scores during the pandemic, as well as projections that the learning losses could reduce lifetime earnings for affected students, you know, because a lot of schools closed during COVID, and he didn't seem to think that was such a hot idea.
Did the former CDC director respond to his concerns?
Not really. I mean, you know, he just talked to her about current vaccine guidance and asking whether parents of healthy school-aged children would be endangering the lives of their healthy children if they don't get them vaccinated for COVID-19. And I'm not sure that that is something that people are suggesting that healthy children get at this point. But she just said that she thought that parents should consult with pediatricians about the benefits and risks.
Tell us about Senator Bernie Moreno's clash with a senator from Nevada. What was this resolution that the Nevada senator introduced, and, you know, what was that clash about?
All right. Now, one of the things that happens in the Senate is that senators can try to bring things up on the Senate floor under, you know, for expedited consideration by the Senate, that they think, oh, I think many times they don't think that it's something that the Senate is going to hang up, is going to sign off on without difficulty, but they just want to do it for political reasons. So Senator Jackie Rosen, who's a Nevada Democrat, introduced a resolution opposing Florida's decision to roll back its requirements for schools, because, you know, a lot of schools require, you know, if you want to send your kid to school, they have to have a certain number of inoculations for particular things. And I believe that the rationale for that is so that to avoid, you know, spreading some of these diseases, right? And so she introduced a resolution opposing Florida's decision to roll those back in the state. And Senator Moreno objected to that. And, you know, he seemed to think that that states should be allowed to do what they want to do, and that people should be allowed to not get vaccines if they don't want to, you know, making an argument that I thought this was kind of interesting, is he said that what RFK is saying, our Secretary of Health is saying, is we're not going to mandate that people have to put things into their body that they choose not to put in their body. And then he talked about Democrats saying, I believe over my lifetime, what I've seen Democrats say is my body, my choice. I guess that only applies when you're murdering babies. And that was exactly what he said. So that's where Moreno stands on that.
Okay. Well, let's turn from the nation's capital to Ohio's capital. Karen, three unions representing educators are suing over a provision in Ohio's state budget. What's the provision, and why are they suing?
Well, they're suing because the state budget would make changes to the board that oversees the state teacher's retirement system, the pension fund that pays out to teachers and retirees. And they claim that that's unconstitutional. The change would mean that the board would, instead of having seven educators with seats on the board right now, that would gradually by 2028 go down to three seats for educators. So they filed their lawsuit. They got a temporary order to block the enforcement of this provision. But there's been a lot of issues with regard to the state teachers' retirement system. There's been some high-profile resignations. There was an internal probe after an anonymous memo accused people of corruption. There was a special audit. Teachers themselves hired an outside expert on pensions to come in and to look at the investments and the payouts that were coming from STRS, because they were concerned they weren't getting an annual cost of living increase and they didn't understand why. And they were suggesting that maybe there were some funny things going on with the investment mix. So this is a long-standing concern among teachers about how their pension system is managed. And so for right now, we're in kind of a holding pattern here in terms of what the budget would do with regard to changing the makeup of that board. But state lawmakers, Republican state lawmakers, had wanted to change that board, feeling that having more appointees and more control essentially over the board was the best way to go.
You mentioned that teachers have had concerns about the state teachers retirement system in the past. Are the unions still worried about how it's operating?
Oh, sure. And they continue to be. I mean, that there's, this is a longstanding and kind of complicated story that goes back, I mean, at least a couple of years here with regard to how the fund has been managed, and the real questions about, is the fund being managed as well as other funds are being managed? And is there going to be enough money to cover teachers? I mean, for a long time, teachers did not get Social Security. They now do, thanks to a law that passed in Congress. But obviously, this is their retirement. So they're very concerned about it and feel that their voices need to be on the board that oversees the system that manages their pensions.
Well, I want to talk about another priority that at least one Republican lawmaker has. Tell us about this new legislation that's being drafted, the Tithing Protection Act.
Yeah, this is a bill from Republican Josh Williams, who's a representative from Northwest Ohio. And the bill would basically give a tax credit for Ohioans who regularly donate to their churches. Now, tithing, of course, typically means 10%. But he says that there wouldn't necessarily be a cap or a floor on this. In fact, he specifically said that if a millionaire wants to give $1 million to his or her church, then that would be completely acceptable to him. He says that this is appropriate because he feels that Ohio provided tax relief to some of its richest residents in the last budget, and that he supported that, but this would provide tax relief to people who are not as well off, but who are giving money to their churches regularly.
Do other states allow deductions for tithing?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they do. 29 states do allow for deductions, and it's not really a deduction. It's a tax credit. It's a little bit, a tax person could explain this a lot better than I am. But Ohio is among 14 states that don't allow for such deductions right now. But this would, of course, change that. It's bipartisan, which is interesting to note because a lot of the bills that we talk about are not bipartisan, but this one is.
Any idea how much this would cost Ohio in tax revenue if this were to become law?
Yeah, Williams did not have any figures when he introduced this. And the way that things work here is that a bill would have to actually go through at least a hearing before the Legislative Service Commission, which is the panel, the researchers who do work for state lawmakers on bills that they've proposed. It would take a hearing first before a cost analysis would go forward. And then we might know a little bit more. But Williams says, hey, this is money that people should be giving to their, should be getting credit for giving to their churches. So he feels that it shouldn't cost the state. He feels that saying it'll cost the state money is not a fair way to put it, but that's just kind of word definition here, I guess.
There you go. Would this only be for churches?
Well, and that's the question. When I asked him specifically whether this would apply to mosques and synagogues and other houses of worship, he said yes. But the bill only references churches, so that's certainly going to come up, especially when you've got bipartisan support for an issue like this. You're certainly going to have that question asked and maybe changes made if it doesn't specifically make sure that that's the case. But he says it does apply to others besides just Christian churches.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Sabrina Eaton and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
You too. Are you already thinking about November's election? Join me at 8 p.m. next Wednesday, September 24th, at our new building for a live politics show. It's free, but space is limited. You can register at wvxu.org. Up next, Hamilton County residents confront police chiefs and judges with their concerns about crime. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Hamilton County residents shared their frustration about crime to area police chiefs and judges. Joining me now to talk about the concerns they raised and other city news are WCPO9 News multimedia journalist Jay Shakur and Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Scott Wortman. Welcome back, Scott and Jay.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Jay, you were at this public safety listening session last night that drew residents from across Hamilton County. Tell us about the impetus for this meeting. Who called it and why?
Definitely. It was called by CPD Police Chief Teresa Thiege. She called all of the 35 chiefs together and said, hey, we need to have a meeting. This was in wake of that viral downtown brawl and other violence events happening throughout Cincinnati that got a lot of attention. Shootings in OTR, et cetera. So she called and said, hey, we need to have a meeting. And they had a private closed door meeting. But then in that meeting, the Police Chiefs Association's president, Evendale Police Chief Tim Holloway, said, hey, we should probably take this conversation to the public. You know, we're not elected like some other positions. And so if we're going to make decisions, make changes, better how we approach public safety and enforcing the law, we should probably get public feedback. And so from there, they wanted to host these town halls, and last night's town hall was one of what I'm told will be several in the coming months to get feedback from community members and taxpayers.
There can sometimes be a perception, Jay, that the people concerned about crime are from the suburbs. Which neighborhoods were represented at this meeting last night?
That's a true perception that you get, but there was an array of people. There were people from Delhi, obviously, where it was hosted. Avondale, Price Hill, West Price Hill. So there was a big mix. Obviously, Delhi was the, from my account and my talking to people, was the had the most numbers, if you will, because that's where it was hosted. But there was a, an array of people from different neighborhoods across the city coming to express some of their concerns and ask their questions.
Yeah. Well, here's Amber Kassam from Price Hill.
I'm seeing canceled calls and broadcasted calls go up. I'm seeing quality of life issues be responded to going down. I'm seeing the number of sex workers on Warsaw Avenue go up. I'm seeing the number of heroin needles that I find in our business district go up. I'm seeing the number of children displaced from the parks go up.
What are some of the other concerns you heard from residents last night, Jay?
Definitely. That's Amber from West Price Hill. They talked about a lot of things. She listed just a few of them, but they were particularly interested in getting more information about the data, going to that idea of perception versus reality. You say crime is down and you cite these numbers and these statistics, but we don't feel that. What is the methodology behind tracking that data? You know, how can we trust the data? That was brought up from some residents. Also, they wanted more quality of life issues, similar to what she mentioned and that Amber was talking about. They want quality of life issues dealt with as well in terms of loitering, defaced and abandoned properties. Particularly, a lot of people talked about, and this was something enlightening to me as just a reporter, hearing concerns and talking to people constantly. This was like kind of new for me, but hearing the issue with halfway houses and the concentration of group homes in particular neighborhoods, you know, it seems from some residents that that's not being enforced or there's not enough regulation to prevent some, you know, illicit activity from happening. Repeat offenders was a big thing. And because the judges were there, there were seven judges there. They couldn't speak because of ethical reasons, but they were there to listen, taking notes. They did talk among themselves, but they couldn't speak directly to the residents or answer any of the residents' questions because of those ethical issues. But they did have questions about bail. How do you make these decisions about bail? We hear repeat offenders and we see people in the news constantly that are being arrested, or we hear this person has a long rap sheet. Why did you let them out? So they brought up an array of issues from what the courts do to what the police can and can't do. To even what citizens can do in terms of helping law enforcement. Hmm.
Sounds like it covered a lot of ground. Well, here is Evendale Police Chief Tim Holloway addressing questions about youth crime.
The way that laws are structured in Ohio right now, it is very difficult to hold a parent criminally liable.
So tell us more about how the police chiefs responded at this forum last night, Jay.
Definitely. They were very open, very direct, very transparent. If they didn't have a complete answer, they directly told you that. Or if they were still searching for an answer, they directly told you that. He was particularly responding there to the big outcry and a question from a couple of our viewers that reached out to us before the town hall asking, hey, we see youth violence. We see youth engaged in bad activity. Why aren't you able to hold the parents accountable? Perhaps that will curve some of their behavior if you're holding the parents accountable. And that was his answer. The laws in Ohio make it very hard. And the follow-up to that I asked was, hey, what specifically needs to change? And then the answer to that was, we are looking into what we can constitutionally and legally do. And that's part of the reason we're having these town halls, to get feedback from residents, to bring all the stakeholders to the table to see what we can do and then present on a state level in terms of lawmaking for change.
Jay, you mentioned that there are several other forums that will be happening that are in the works. Are there other ways for residents to contact law enforcement about their concerns?
Yes. So they haven't announced publicly any future dates, but they do plan to have those forums come. I was told by the Police Chiefs Association President, even though Police Chief Tim Holloway, that they will be the next few months of the year to sort of close out the year. Those dates to be determined. But you can follow the Police Chiefs Association's Facebook page. Just started at the end of last month. They're pushing people to follow that page, to connect directly to them, to know what's going on, to plug in. It's public. It's a Facebook page. You can leave comments. You can message. Get in contact with not just your particular police chief, but you will have the audience or the ear of all of the police chiefs, because it is the Police Chiefs Association page on Facebook. So Hamilton County Police Chiefs Association on Facebook, that's how they're asking people to contact them. And also still your local precinct, you can still obviously reach out there for any concerns. And the big push out of last night as well was, if you have a camera on your home, surveillance camera, please consider letting your local police department know so that they can track that. That helps them, they say, greatly in a lot of the crimes that residents complain about.
Well, thank you, Jay. We really appreciate that. Scott, I want to talk about some other city news. We had city officials on the show earlier this week. They told us the city has amped up parking enforcement. What did you find in your reporting? Is the city issuing more parking tickets?
They are. This is kind of an example of how open records requests can sometimes be fun. It's not always drudgery. The mayor had mentioned a few months ago, actually, and what kind of like jump-started me looking at it, when they were coming up with the city budget, he mentioned one of the ways that they're increasing revenue is through writing, you know, more parking tickets and more parking enforcement, which got me wondering. I mean, I park downtown a lot. I mean, I make sure to feed the meters and obey the traffic signs, but, you know, I see a lot of people, a lot of traffic or parking officers writing tickets out there. So I asked for every all the parking tickets that the city wrote in the last 10 years. This past year was the most parking tickets they've written since 2019, since the pandemic. So they're starting to ramp it up, but they've hired more parking officers. So, they expect to see, it's probably safe to say you should obey the traffic, parking signs when you're downtown, but yes, they are writing, they wrote 93,000 parking tickets, in the past year. That's up from about 70-some thousand the previous year. And it's probably going to be higher this year since they have full staff out there looking for parking violators.
Do you know what's behind the increased enforcement? I mean, is it to generate more money for the city?
Well, I mean, that is part of it. But they being city officials in the transportation department, say that's only part of it. The actual main motivation is to keep traffic moving and parking spaces available downtown. And this actually came out of a recommendation a year ago from the Futures Commission, which was a group of business leaders and community leaders that the city pulled together to look at ways to, improve development downtown, improve revenue, and how the city runs. And one of the recommendations that they came out with was increasing parking enforcement. And in the report that they issued, their reason wasn't so much the money, it was more to address business complaints that, you know, people are taking up parking spaces for an inordinate amount of time, making it harder for other people to find parking. And this basically, their motive is to make it more pleasant and easier to patronize businesses downtown.
Where are people most likely to get ticketed?
Well, that was interesting. And you'd expect downtown, and that was the bulk of the tickets, but it was two blocks in particular in between Paycor Stadium. I almost called it Paul Brown again. I'm still getting used to that. Paycor Stadium and Great American Ballpark on East Freedom Way and West Freedom Way. And the reason for that, I mean, this kind of goes back to the crime discussion that Jay was talking about. That was the topic of that meeting. There has been a concerted effort to crack down on crime and loitering at the banks along the river. And they have increased police presence down there. They've put restrictions where you can't park late at night on Freedom Way. This has happened in the last about 2 years or so, and it's resulted in a significant amount of parking tickets. I mean, those two blocks accounted for about the same amount of parking tickets as all of Vine Street, which is one of the longest roads in the city that goes from the river to the southern border in Hartwell. But it was over, now the number is escaping me, it was like 3,900 parking tickets in the last year issued on a two-block stretch of East Freedom Way and West Freedom Way. So if you're parking down there, be sure to read the signs.
Are there times of year when you're more likely to get a ticket?
Yeah, and I don't really know what to make of that, but October is the, because we just kind of, me and my colleague, Betsy Kim, just crunched the decade's worth of data. And October, for whatever reason, had the most tickets over the past decade, about 90,000, I think, which is more than any other month. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what that indicates. It's just kind of interesting. We also sorted by make of car, and Hondas were the most numerous. Most tickets were issued to Hondas for some reason. So if you're driving a Honda in October and you're at the banks, be sure you are parking according to the law.
How much are parking tickets these days? Do you know?
The base, and it varies depending on what it is, because these are parking tickets for anything. I mean, a lot of them downtown were for expired meters and parking in no parking zones. But the base is $65. That's where they start at. They raised it a couple years ago from $50. So that's also increased revenue because the city collect they had $5.9 million worth of fines in the last year. They collected so far about $4 million of that. I mean, not everyone pays their parking tickets. And there are late fees then if you don't pay. But so 65 is like the cheapest that you can get off with a parking fine.
Now, I know you said you follow the rules, you're very careful when you park, you feed the meters, you read the signs, but has this reporting changed how and where you park?
No. I mean, it's the app that they have and some of the lots there, which are privately run, and that's kind of a separate issue because the city is also looking at having uniform regulations for how those operate. With the apps, a lot of this stuff is almost automatic as far as like just paying and, you know, quickly just feeding the meter. I don't have to carry around a bunch of change anymore.
Yeah, as long as you have the apps. I'm such a jerk about loading those apps onto my phone. Okay.
So I did hear afterwards, and I'm looking into it. Some people have had problems paying the apps late at night, so I'm going to see if that's an issue. But, you know, obviously with any technology, there can be glitches.
Sure. Well, let's talk now about this railway sale money. Cincinnati voters in 2023 approved the sale of Cincinnati Southern Railway. Remind us just briefly what the proceeds of that sale are supposed to be paying for.
The voters approved it. This was a massive issue in 2023. There were public forums about it, some of which got surprisingly heated. A lot of people had strong feelings about this. But the rationale for it, it goes towards infrastructure to maintain existing infrastructure, not like to just build like pie in the sky stuff, is to do mostly road rehabilitation, repavings, potholes, things like that. That's what in the first year that they've got the proceeds from it, about 62% went to just that. But also like repairing and rehabbing stuff in the city parks, rec centers, basically existing infrastructure and maintaining that.
So there's a board, there's a board that oversees the trust that where all this money sits from the sale. How much did that board allocate to the city for the upcoming fiscal year? And how does that compare to what the city got this year?
Yes. They had predicted the city officials that were pushing the railroad sale had predicted it would return the investment, the $1.6 billion that they got for selling it to the railroad, Norfolk Southern, is in a trust fund that is invested in bonds and a lot of like safe, not low risk type of investments. They expected it would return about $56 million a year. And that's what they got this past, this current fiscal year. Which is the first year they're getting proceeds. And the investments, according to the analysts that the trust fund contracts with, said it's been a solid year. They've gotten a decent return on investments, although there's some concerning signs with the economy coming up. But again, they said that the investments are fairly safe. That they have enough to return $57.4 million. The railway board rounded up to $58 million. So the city will get an additional $2 million compared to last year to put towards roads, bridges, and parks.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer City Hall reporter Scott Wortman and WCPO9 News multimedia journalist Jay Shakur. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
Up next, is academic freedom dead? This is Cincinnati Edition. Mark your calendar. We've got a live Cincinnati Edition politics show at 8 p.m. next Wednesday, September 24th, and you're invited. It's free, but space is limited. Register now at wvxu.org. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. University of Cincinnati students held a funeral for academic freedom. Joining me now to explain why is WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
I want to start with state report cards. We're going to get to the funeral, but Ohio's school report cards came out this week. Remind us what the grading scale is and what schools are graded on.
Yeah, so this is an annual report that uses a 5-star scale, so 1 to 5 stars, with 1 being the lowest, 5 being the highest. And it rates school districts based on things like their achievement on state tests, student progress, gap closure, which is how students are progressing and improving, the graduation rate, and early literacy.
Anything new this year?
Why, yes, there is, Lucy. Yeah, there is something new this year. So folks might remember that the Ohio Department of Education used to be called the Ohio Department of Education. Now it's called the Ohio Department of Education and Workforce. So new this year is the College Career and Workforce and Military Readiness Rating. So this is something that was actually measured for schools for the past couple of years, but it didn't count towards their overall rating. So this has caused a couple of changes. So we've definitely seen the workforce rating have an impact on these scores for some of the schools that last year earned 5 stars, and it's actually helped some schools that were not meeting the state standard kind of reach that benchmark. So last year, 10 local school districts here in the Cincinnati area got a 5-star rating. This year, it's down to 6. So we're seeing this new component of the report card rating kind of factor in and change things up for a couple districts.
Interesting. What's the benchmark the state wants school districts to meet?
3 stars. So about 40% of districts statewide across Ohio kind of landed in the middle there around that 3-star rating.
Okay. And you mentioned, I think you said 6 school districts in our area got the highest rating, the 5 stars.
That 5-star perfect rating, yeah.
Yeah. How many districts fell below that state benchmark?
7 school districts that include Cincinnati Public Schools, Mount Healthy, North College Hill, Middletown, St. Bernard, Elmwood, and Wooten Woods all scored either 2.5 or lower, around 2.
Huh. Well, Cincinnati Public Schools, you just mentioned, that's our biggest district in the region. Did the district have any areas of improvement?
Yeah, they did. One of the big areas of improvement was that graduation rate. That is something we've seen CPS improve on year over year. It's been small improvement, 1%, 2% each year. But this year, it went from 82% last year to 86%. So that's a pretty significant improvement for CPS on that front. So even though they received a 2.5, which is still below state standards, and the same score they received last year, there were small areas of improvement, but certainly there were some things that were dragging them down.
Yeah, where's the district struggling?
It continues to be chronic absenteeism. Things have been tough for CPS on this front. In the district, 45% are considered chronically absent. That's like missing 10 days or more. So, you know, school district leaders have been saying this for a long time. It's really challenging to get students in the classroom. Once you get them there, you can help them reach those goals, but getting them into the building, into the classroom, continues to be a challenge, not just for CPS, but for other school districts as well, because of things like budget cuts. Districts tend to look at transportation to kind of limit their costs. But of course, when you cut bus routes, when you shift kids from yellow buses to the metro bus system, it makes it harder for kids to actually get to school every day. And we're kind of seeing the effects, even though chronic absenteeism statewide has been going down, at CPS continues to be an issue.
Well, I want to move to higher education now. UC has fewer international graduate students this fall. What are the numbers? What are the reasons behind that decrease?
Yeah, we saw a pretty significant decline in international students in just 1 year. So this fall, they're seeing more than 700 fewer graduate students coming internationally. So that's a pretty steep decline in a single year. So that's going from 2,900 down to about 2,100, a little bit over that. So that's a 25% decrease in a single year. And that's pretty significant for graduate studies at UC because international students make up about 20% of that total graduate student population. So when you lose international students like that, it takes a pretty significant hit on the university.
Yeah. What are some of the reasons behind that decrease?
Well, it's been related to some changes in the federal administration. There have been visa bans this year. Certain countries have been banned and their visas won't be approved if you're from a certain country. But also there's been stricter immigration policies overall. And also there was a pause on visa interviews later this year. So it delayed some of the process for people. And some people were not able to complete their visa applications because of that. But also, we've seen what's been happening across the country. It's kind of a tough time to be an immigrant. So certainly there is a fear among international students. Do I want to risk coming to the U.S. to study? If there's an issue with paperwork, am I going to be detained or am I going to be deported? There is some serious questions about that among international students.
Where did you see the biggest declines in terms of countries?
India and China, students that come from those countries, that's where we're seeing the most significant decline. And of course, those are the largest international student groups that come to campus. So if we're factoring in students from India, graduate and undergraduate, it's 728 fewer students this year, almost a 33% change. So we're seeing a huge shift there. And typically, those students from India and China are enrolling in UC's engineering and information technology master's programs. These are also medical students as well. So certainly 700 students. When I spoke to UC's Jack Miner, manager of enrollment, he says 700 students, that's 700 researchers, 700 discoveries. So there has been a significant impact on kind of the research that's going to be done at UC this year. It's going to look a lot different.
What about financial impact? Don't international students typically pay a lot more in tuition than local students?
Yeah, they pay a lot more in tuition, and of course, they're working jobs here as well. Jack Miner said that many of them stay in the region after they graduate and become part of the local workforce, or they start their own businesses. So some folks are predicting about I believe it was $200 million impact on the state of Ohio with the loss of international students here. So certainly there are a lot of concerns there about having all of these students really suddenly missing. And really this correlates with an overall decline in graduate students at UC because even though overall UC showed a larger enrollment this year, a lot of that was undergraduate students. And we're not really seeing domestic U.S. students filling these slots because there are, UC was reporting 896 fewer graduate students this year. So obviously the loss of those international students, it's being felt overall.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about this funeral that I've been talking about for the entire show. It wasn't like any funeral I've ever been to. What was this funeral all about?
This was a funeral put on by a couple student leaders and some faculty at the University of Cincinnati. And this was for the death of academic freedom. And this is something that's been thrown around by some faculty and students in the wake of Senate Bill 1. which kind of has been reforming higher education in Ohio and changing things up as far as it relates to DEI, faculty organizing, that kind of thing. Basically, what they said was that this is kind of, you know, destroying parts of the university that the community has relied on. Mm. In the past year, UC has gotten rid of its African-American Cultural Center, its LGBTQ plus center, its women's center, and its, you know, services for other minority students. So a lot of big changes have come to UC this year, but also this has had an impact on, you know, what people can say and what they can teach and kind of the issues that they can talk about. It's very tense times for some faculty there. And, you know, they're worried that as Senate Bill 1 continues to be implemented on college campuses, it is going to destroy these universities and have a negative impact over time.
Yeah. Well, we only have a little more than a minute left, but there are some differences in the way Ohio universities are interpreting Senate Bill 1. Can you talk just briefly about that?
Yeah. Senate Bill 1 has not really clearly defined what DEI is, so it's been interpreted differently. At Ohio State University, they banned students from chalking, writing messages in chalk on the ground. They've also banned certain decorations in dorms, and they also banned land acknowledgments. And that hasn't been interpreted the same at universities. So Miami is not banning land acknowledgments, and it's just kind of being interpreted differently by different universities. There's a lot of inconsistencies with how people are implementing it. And it seems like universities are still looking for clarification on this. So we'll see if they get that.
Yeah. Is that something that concerns students too?
Yeah, certainly. Because the concern that I am hearing from faculty and students is that they're really just capitulating. The university leaders are capitulating the state government and just kind of going along or complying in advance when they don't fully understand what the bill is asking universities to do. So they're banning things that are not explicitly banned in the law. So it's being implemented differently everywhere, which is causing a lot of confusion. And we kind of don't really know what's going to be coming next with this.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Thank you so much for your time today, Zach.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez Cornu. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to go to our website and RSVP for our politics show next week. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.